for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In 2001, Israel began building a security barrier along the 1949 armistice line, but it often meandered away from the Green Line. In 2003, Israeli security forces planned to route the barrier through the Palestinian village of Budrus. A community leader named Ayad Morar united rival political factions, villagers of all ages, international and Israeli human rights activists in a successful nonviolent protest to save their land. Ayad Morar joins us in the studio to talk about the growth of a Palestinian unarmed resistance movement. With us are filmmakers Julia Basha and Ronit Abni, whose documentary titled Budrus is part of the Silver Docs Documentary Festival, now showing here in Washington. If you'd like to join us on the program, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you. It's good to have you here.
Good morning.
Julia, I wonder if you could tell us what brought your interest to this story in particular.
For the last 6 years, I've been working together with Ronit Avni and our other producer, Rula Salameh, and some other colleagues in an organization called Just Vision. And we've been documenting Israeli and Palestinian efforts to end the conflict nonviolently over this time. Our first film was called Encounter Point. And in that one, we talked about bereaved families who had overcome their grief to work together towards peace. And we often got the question when touring with that film about where is the Palestinian nonviolence movement? Now that you know that there are good Israelis and good Palestinians, how can those civilians work together to create concrete change? And we started researching, and everybody started pointing to the village of Budrus and to the leadership of Ayad Morar and what he had been able to do in his village by uniting not only all local political parties, but getting women in the front lines and Israelis, Israeli activists, many of whom for the first time took the courage to cross the Green Line and demonstrate side by side with Palestinians.
And so you began researching this whole area and what was happening there.
It became clear that the model that the village of Budrus had established in using standard tactics of civil disobedience for succeeding in preserving all of their land and making possible for the community to remain where they've been for centuries, that model had spread to other villages. And what we wanted to go back to is tell the story of how it all started, because many people all over the world kept asking, where is the Palestinian nonviolence movement? And we knew that it was happening, that it existed, but it was invisible. And it was important for us to bring this story to the international community and to Israelis and Palestinians too, many of whom do not know about it.
Julia Basha, she is director, producer, writer of Budrus. She wrote and co-directed the feature documentary Encounter Point and co-wrote and edited Control Room. We are now talking about a new film that is being shown as part of the Silver Docs Film Festival, being shown here in Washington. Turning to you, Ronit Avni, how did you become involved in this process?
I am an Israeli citizen, I'm a Canadian citizen, recent American, and my background is in human rights work. For many years, I was working with human rights advocates around the world, including Israeli and Palestinian human rights researchers and reporters. And I found that the work that they were doing on the ground was largely invisible. And so there was so much media attention for militancy and militarism and policymakers, but almost nothing about people on the ground trying to do something about the injustices and about the conflict. And so I began a research process for 2 years. I interviewed 475 Israelis and Palestinians in the field and found that invisibility was one of their greatest challenges. And that led to the creation of the organization that Julia mentioned, Just Vision, that I've been a part of and the founder of since 2003. So for me, telling these stories is not about, you know, good stories or propaganda or anything along those lines. It's about a complete story. It's trying to complete the coverage that we receive so that we understand both the obstacles and challenges that we see in terms of violence in the region and stalemates and stagnation, but also what are the concrete things that people are doing to try to move it forward.
Ronit, where do you live?
I just moved to Washington recently, so I am now a new resident, and I had lived in Jerusalem. I've lived in Montreal. My father and much of my family lives in Israel currently, so I go back and forth. And we have an office in Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem, so we're back and forth, our whole team, quite frequently.
And Julia, you're originally from?
Brazil.
And that's a long way for you to be going to concentrate on this issue. What was it about your Brazilian background that you brought to this?
That's an interesting question. I think that what I experienced being Brazilian was that there was a lot of welcoming from both societies. There wasn't a fear or an assumption that I came with a specific prejudice. The fact that Palestinians and Israelis love football and are crazy about it, and I am too, definitely helped often break the ice. And there's been a few situations both in the Palestinian community and in the Israeli community where my nationality helped. That wasn't why I chose to do it. I became interested while studying Middle Eastern history and politics at Columbia University. 9/11 happened when I was in school in New York. And obviously, it became something very emotional for me being there and seeing the crisis in the city and in the country. And I wanted to really learn more about it and dedicated, you know, the past few years for that.
And now turning to you, Ayed Morar. You are an employee at the Palestinian Interior Ministry and a community organizer. Tell us about your own background and where your convictions for peaceful protest come from.
I am a Palestinian like other Palestinians, suffering from the occupation, living under the bad situation, the occupation affecting us as a person in many levels. As a nation, they are affecting us. As any Palestinian, we have right and we have a duty. According to my opinion, I have a duty to struggle against the occupation. But according to my opinion, we have to choose the best way to struggle against the occupation, even if we have the right, but according also to my mentions, the nonviolent struggle is the best way to collect all the people around the world to persuade them that we aren't against anybody. We aren't against the Israelis. We aren't against Jews. We just against the occupation. And we need help from all the people around the world. It's not enough for us to spend our life blaming this one or that one who is supporting Israel or not. We must do the best in order to persuade the people that we need our normal and human rights, freedom, and real peace. So I spent all my life, and the first time I get arrested at 1981 when I was about 19 years old. And during my studying in university, I was involved in nonviolent struggling. and I initiate with many other colleagues the popular arm of the Fatah organization, where we care for helping the farmers in cleaning the streets. No government, Palestinian government, work care for the these things. And after that, I involved in the first intifada. I got arrested for 5 times. I have been injured by two alive Muslims in my body. But it's my our freedom price. We have to be able to pay it. And we didn't choose the nonviolent struggle to escape from this price.
So what you're saying is that you did participate in the first intifada. For you, what was the experience of being wounded like? How did that affect your thinking about nonviolent protest?
The nonviolent protest in Palestine is more complicated, more difficult to choose, but it's more necessary, more important, more useful. The first intifada, when we it was forbidden for us to raise a Palestinian flags, forbidden for us to write slogans on the walls, forbidden for us to make strikes. This kind of activities, they were the components of the first intifada, and it bring much support for our struggle in this nonviolent struggle. Recently, when we started against the wall in 2003, we managed to see that in the first time the Israelis, who are against the occupation and wanting really to build a real peace with us, and we appreciate them, we have a warm feeling toward them, and we saw 35 nationalities to support us.
Ayed Marar, he is an employee at the Palestinian Interior Ministry as well as a community organizer. Short break, we'll be right back. And if you've just joined us, we're talking about a new film that is titled Budrus. It's part of the Silver Docs Documentary Festival, now showing in Washington, and tells the story of a barrier that was going to be constructed through the Palestinian village of Budrus. A community leader named Ayad Marar, who is with me this morning, united rival political factions and villagers of all ages in a successful nonviolent protest to save his land. He is here with me in the studio, along with Julia Basha and Ronit Avni. Ronit is founder and executive director of Just Vision. That's a nonprofit organization researching and documenting Palestinian and Israeli grassroots leaders in nonviolence and peace building. Julia Basha is director, producer, writer of the film Boudras. Now, to you, Ayad Marar, explain what happened with this barrier.
At November 2003, the Israeli government hang flags on the trees. They didn't tell anybody. They just hang the papers on the trees, and the sheep keepers find them. They told that we want to confiscate this part of land in order to build the Israeli wall. And at that plan, they had to confiscate 1,200 dunams, which equal to 300 acres, planted with 3,000 olive trees. And they told us, you have 2 weeks to complain to the Israeli court. But next day, they brought the bulldozers and they start work on the land. So we thought that no chance to go to the Israeli court. Through these 2 weeks, they can destroy everything. So we initiate a popular committee, which means to represent all the components of the Palestinian and Boudras community, and that committee to care and to put a tactics and strategy for our struggling against the wall. The wall, we think that it will stop our children's food. It will uprooting our olive trees, which we care very much about it. It means much for our life. And they want to kill our dream to build an independent state because they try to surround it us and many and 5 other villages with the wall without any regular connection with the rest of the West Bank. Our universities are outside this ghetto. Our hospitals are outside this ghetto. Our jobs, all our life connected to Ramallah city, and to connect this area with Ramallah with a metal gate open or closed according to the soldier order, it will be much difficult and much horrible.
Julia Basha, how did you first learn that this wall was going to be constructed? How did you begin communicating with the people within Boudras?
We have been part of, really following what's going on the ground for many years now. We have an office in Jerusalem, so we've been following the developments on the ground. We have producers that are full-time there. So we know what's happening very closely. When we decided to make the movie, we already knew that the development of the resistance had happened and that they had succeeded. So our job was actually to go back and find Israeli activists, American activists, French activists, Swedish activists who were there and had cameras, not to make a film at the time, but actually to document potential human rights violations and to be able to use it in case it was necessary to give it to the press or to take it to the courts. What we, in our research, what we found that was very interesting is that there were unlikely allies in this fight against the original route of the separation barrier.
On the
Israeli side. Not only those Israeli activists, but a group called the Council for Peace and Security, which is made up of retired generals, people with a lot of credibility in the security realm of the Israeli government, who were also taking cases of other villages, not Boudras, to the Israeli court, saying that Israeli security was being compromised by actually taking Palestinian land and Palestinian rights. And Boudras is just one of the villages, I should point out, that was affected severely by the route of the separation barrier.
And to you, Ronit, this question of the signs being hung saying you have 2 weeks to protest and then the bulldozers show up the next day, what recourse did the villagers have in that situation?
The villagers, I think, calculated that they couldn't afford to wait. And in fact, in some communities where they did wait and they did try to go through the High Court of Justice, there have been villages where Palestinians have lost land and livelihood and access. And even if the High Court supports the decision of moving the path of the barrier, which happened in Bil'in, for example, another village, it has yet to be moved according to the court's request. So, and also at that time, some other villages had already been destroyed. And so I think the villagers felt that they couldn't wait for their own representatives to come in. They couldn't wait for not the Palestinian Authority, not the Israeli government, not the international community, that they really had to stop construction so that they wouldn't be faced with a situation where 5 years down the line they were appealing to the High Court of Justice to try to get it moved once the fabric had already been destroyed within the community.
So tell me what happened next, Ayet.
We try to stop the bulldozers.
How?
To collect or to gather the Palestinian community, women, men, old people, the young, everybody, to go to stop the bulldozers.
To stand
in front of them. Even the soldiers, we don't aim to come back with them.
You had no weapons?
No weapons, just no our barbadies. We went to the bulldozers and we managed many times to stop them and to push them away from our land. Many times they succeed to push us back to our village, but this comeback to start for more than 10 months. And after that, they have to bring more than 150 soldiers to protect for mad bulldozers who are uprooting the olive trees. But at last, we managed to stop the bulldozers.
How?
And one moment, in the beginning, in the first demonstration, Israeli commander wanted to advise me, as he told me, that what you are doing here, are you crazy? You believe that by your small village you can stop a governmental decision? We build already more than 100 kilometers from this wall and nobody do nothing. So if by your losing two martyrs you will succeed, I will encourage you. But even if you lose 60 martyrs from your village, we will never change even 1 centimeter from the wall. I told him this is a bad decision. This is not our destiny. We have another decision, and we will see. And we continue struggling, continue going, trying to stop the bulldozers and to prevent them to enter to our fields. And one moment, in one demonstration, that the commander gathered the journalist and told him, we decide to move the wall close to the green line. And it was a very great decision, but it's still a small point in Palestine, because all the Palestinian village till now are suffering from the wall.
And joining us now by phone is David Makovsky. He's director of the Project on Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's co-author with Dennis Ross of Myths, Illusions, and Peace. Good morning, David. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you, Diane.
I know you have not yet seen this film, but give us your perspective on the history of Israel's security barrier and what you've heard this morning about the notification of the town of Budrus that their land was going to be taken, that they had 2 weeks to protest, and the bulldozers showed up the next day.
Well, Diane, first of all, I think for our listeners, it's important to realize that this is a real change, the nonviolence focus in the Palestinian movement. It's still a small element, but it could grow, and it's a real change from the focus on suicide bombing, which has really tragically been the defining element in much of the last 20 years. So I don't know the specifics here in the case of Budrus, but I think this new focus on nonviolence is something that should be applauded. I think it's important to understand, in the big picture, why was this barrier set up? I mean, there was no barrier from 1967, when Israel gained the West Bank, until 2002. What happened was between 2000 and 2004 was what we call the Second Intifada. That means the Second Palestinian Uprising. And there were 132 Palestinian suicide bombers that went through the Israeli security forces and blew themselves up and killed over 1,000 Israelis. You know, this, in many ways, this barrier was the barrier, in my view, that Hamas, the leading force on suicide bombers, they built it. The Israelis and Palestinians used to mix much more freely up until that point. And, you know, I should say there was been suffering on both sides, a lot of Palestinians, casualties, fatalities, too, even more than Israelis. But the context for the Israeli decision to build the barrier was that the Israelis just didn't want to get blown up. You know, I was looking at the polls at this time. I spent a year working on this issue of the barrier. Where does demography meet geography in the West Bank? What I found in the polling data was that 84% of the Israeli public supported it. The entire Jewish population of Israel, every single Jewish person in Israel, is less than 80%. So here you had 84%. So it was widely supported, and it was really a function of suicide bombings, and that was why Israel had a barrier. There hadn't been a barrier since 67.
All right, but why was the decision made to deviate from the Green Line then cross into Palestinian territory?
Right. No, that's a very fair question. And it's true that, and this is where, again, you have to know a little bit that the population of the settler movement is not evenly distributed across the West Bank. 80% of the settlers live in less than 5% of the land, largely adjacent to the old boundaries. We call that the Green Line of 1967. And that's basically near Israeli cities and towns. And there was a belief that these people were targets, too. But here's the interesting, you know, targets for suicide bombers who need to be protected. But here's the twist, which is counterintuitive, okay? But the twist is that the barrier and the whole idea of demarcating, which would include these settlement clusters, or we call them the settlement blocks, was really the project of the Israeli liberals and not the Israeli conservatives. Israeli conservatives, originally like Sharon, who was forced to build it, believed there should be no line between the West Bank and the Green Line because Israel would have both. The Israeli liberals said, no, there's got to be a two-state solution, and there's a need to demarcate the boundaries. And in fact, the line of the barrier very much correlates to what President Clinton in the year 2000 said would be 5% of the land would be Israeli. I think the barrier at one point reached 8%, but the Israeli court system has pulled it back closer to 5%. And so it was really the project of the Israeli liberals. Now, when there were, you know, there was this infiltration of suicide bombers and people were getting blown up in cafes and buses and movie theaters and discos, everybody supported it, including the right wing. And Sharon, who was against it, and I can show you articles he wrote against the idea of demarcation in the past, was forced to agree. But the Israeli liberals assumed that these blocks, these clusters of settlements near the old boundary, 5% of the land, 8% of the land, would be part of Israel in any formal deal. And if you couldn't reach a two-state solution through a negotiation, in a weird way, by having this barrier, you would be demarcating the two states, and then the parties could always meet and tweak it here and say, well, it's not going to be 5%, it's going to be 4% or 3% or whatever it is. But it would be a psychological reminder to the non-block settlers, those Israelis who don't live in the clusters, who live scattered all over the 95% of the West Bank, that they are on the wrong side and they need to come back.
All right. Now, David, what we have here is a group of individuals who have joined with Ayad Marar to create a peaceful, nonviolent resistance movement and have succeeded, I gather, in doing what you wanted to do, Ayad, to move those bulldozers away from the olive trees, from blocking your community?
I would like to tell that as a Palestinian people, we are understanding the needs of the Israeli security, and we are against killing it anyway. But I have to mention that from 1967 till 2001, yes, there is no walls, but there is a lot of settlements, a lot of the checkpoints, a lot of suffering against the Palestinian people, demolishing homes, uprooting all the trees, killing day and night. And the Palestinian people couldn't obey the opinion of the Israeli population if there is 85% supporting the wall or not. There is 100% from the Palestinian people needs their freedom. And we aren't against the Jews. We aren't and we have a good relationship with those Israelis who took off the occupation from their minds and believe that we can live together, hopefully, peacefully in our land.
Hopefully and peacefully, two very important words. As David Makovsky said earlier, there have been many, many suicide bombings, and perhaps now this approach of peaceful resistance, nonviolent, can work. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, what most of us never knew about the dangers of deep water oil exploration. New York Times science writer Henry Fountain explains the risks and challenges of dropping a drill bit through a mile of seawater, then grinding through 2 miles of rock to reach oil and gas deposits held at dangerous temperatures and pressure. Join us.
All right, we're going to go to the phones as we talk about a brand new film that's going to be shown here in Washington, and I'm sure you will have an opportunity to see portions of it. It's titled Budrus, and it focuses on a village where nonviolent, resistant Palestinians work together with Israelis to prevent the destruction of their village. Let's go to Rockford, Illinois. Good morning, Todd. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to start off by saying thank you for covering this topic. This is a topic that I really wish we'd see a lot more of in this country. I've been traveling to the West Bank for about 17 years now, and I've worked with some of the nonviolent activists that are doing some of the same things you're discussing today in different villages, not in Budrus, but in places like Bilayin and some of the villages that are south of Bethlehem that are doing the same type of nonviolent activism against the wall that's coming through their villages. In fact, I just finished writing a book on it. But these protests happen every week on Fridays, take place in many, many different places across the West Bank, and yet we really hear almost nothing about it. You hear about the violence, but you hear very, very little about this. And in my classes, when I teach on this, I always hear the question that you've already thrown out there, and that's, you know, where's the Palestinian Martin Luther King or Gandhi? And there's quite a few of them. I mean, I wrote a whole book on this. There's some amazing heroic efforts out there in the nonviolent movement. And I guess I'd like your guest to comment on some of the other villages that are doing the same type of thing, maybe not as successfully at times in the sense that they may be losing their land, but they are still advocating nonviolently and heroically.
Thanks for your call, Julia.
Sure. One of the interesting developments today is in the neighborhood of East Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah, where many more Israelis have been able to join the Palestinians because some Israelis might not be ready to actually cross into the Palestinian territories, but it's much easier to go into Jerusalem, where there's a lot of developments happening where Israeli settlers are moving into Palestinian homes in a really massive way. And that is part of, you know, the kind of struggle to know if a two-state solution is going to be viable or not. Palestinians believe that East Jerusalem should be their capital, and the increase in settlements in East Jerusalem is going to ultimately make that impossible. And so there's been a lot of Israelis. A demonstration in March had 3,000 Israelis, not only young people, but actually a lot of religious leaders, many rabbis, older people from a wider range of backgrounds, from people who might not actually be ready to take the risks, the very dangerous risks of actually facing what's happening in Palestinian villages. Because as people can see in the film, the border police officers responded to unarmed children, women with live ammunition. There's been 20 people killed already in different demonstrations in the West Bank. So the level of violence is very high. The price that people have to pay in nonviolent resistance, as I had mentioned, is incredibly high. A community, what they have to be able to bear, the price that they have to pay is tremendous. So it's really important for the international community to pay attention.
All right. And our next caller is former Congresswoman, I'm afraid we've lost her. Former Congresswoman Mary Rose Ocar was on the line with us. I hope she'll call back. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Let's see. Edie, you're on the air.
I wanted to thank you for bringing attention to these nonviolent protests in the West Bank, and I, like the other gentleman in Illinois, has observed many and participated in many. And I just want to disagree that the nonviolent resistance is a new strategy, because although a lot of attention is spent on the violent confrontations in this conflict, nonviolent resistance is not a new phenomena. It goes back to the 20th century with tax revolts, petitions, strikes, and has been consistently employed up through today. And just because the media, especially Western media, ignores this constant presence of nonviolent struggle doesn't mean that it's not in existence. Now, in the West, a lot of people have asked, where's the Gandhi or the MLK? And I would say you have to look in the detention centers. Israel has been cracking down on nonviolent protesters, both in the occupied territories and inside Israel. Palestinians, Israelis, even internationals have come together to protest many things, including the wall, which is 80% built on occupied land, and the demolition of homes and water structures by Israeli forces. And Israel has increased the pressure with nighttime raids into these villages, rounding up and detaining the leaders of this nonviolent movement.
You know, it's interesting, Ayad, that you have not been detained. Why do you suppose that is?
He actually has been detained several times.
Oh,
yes,
you have.
She's asking about, she was thinking that you have never been arrested. Oh. So maybe tell
have
her
you
about.
Have you been arrested? What happened?
For the nonviolence?
I have been arrested for five times. Longest time was for 6 years. I get injured by two live militias during one demonstration in 1990. I have got shot by two rubber bullets in one peaceful demonstration in Nabi Saleh at 2010. And this is a price of our freedom. It's, we have to be ready to pay it.
If you have been arrested, why did they let you go?
Here?
No.
They will judge me and for 6 years, and I will finish my sentence and continue struggle and arrested me again. And they couldn't put me in the jail forever. Even if they will put me in the jail forever, I will never stop struggling against the occupation. This is my duty, and I will be keep going to achieve my targets as a national target, freedom and security.
David Makupski, I wanted to ask you how you react to the idea of armed Israeli soldiers with bulldozers firing at, hitting with
batons,
unarmed individuals.
Well, clearly, you know, I don't think anybody would support, you know, firing, even if it's rubber bullets, you know, if it's not a life-threatening situation. I think it's important, though, for the listeners to the show to understand the main arena here, in my view, and I'm respectful because I definitely respect what your guests are doing, that they're trying to move away from militancy to nonviolence. I think it's very important, and like I said in my remarks, I applaud it. At the same time, we should remember the main arena here is the negotiating table for a two-state solution, and that's what George Mitchell is trying to do. Now Netanyahu has said that he supports it too. I don't think this conflict is going to be settled on the ground between soldiers and protesters.
All right. You want to comment? David.
Okay.
Julia.
Well, I think that people are tired of waiting for negotiations. It's pretty clear right now from the civilian perspective that both governments have failed to deliver their citizens, that the safety of Israelis and the safety of Palestinians for the past few decades have been left to the consequences of failed negotiations. And so what's happening right now on the ground is that Israelis and Palestinians are uniting. These are civilians who are deciding they're no longer going to wait for their governments to make decisions about their future and the safety of their children, and they're going to struggle together.
And Ronit, we've got a number of people asking where this documentary can be shown. Can you give us some information?
Absolutely. So we are taking this film to cities around the world. It will be in the Washington area at Silver Docks this week, tonight at 7:15, and Saturday at 4 o'clock at the AFI Silver Theater. If you visit our website, which is www.justvision.org/Budrus, you can find out events that are taking place. The next cities we'll be in Michigan, we'll be in San Francisco, we're coming back to New York, to LA, and then with listeners' help, we actually welcome those of you who want to email us at info@justvision.org. We want to take this film to churches, mosques, synagogues, theaters, and community centers across the country because it really is a story that's not being told. And just in relation to an earlier caller from Charlotte, North Carolina, this is not the first nonviolence movement in Palestinian society. Absolutely, the 20s, the 30s, the 80s have been times of Palestinian activism nonviolently, but we want to start to tell those stories so that people can engage the issue from an informed place, so we can address it with complexity and sophistication.
All
so
right.
Help us do that.
To a caller here in Washington, D.C., good morning, Anne. You're on the air.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate you finally covering this subject because, as all your guests and callers have said, there is a long history of Palestinian nonviolent resistance. And I wanted to mention that it was a very famous American civil rights activist, Dr. Mary King, who wrote a book called The Quiet Revolution on the First Palestinian Intifada and Nonviolent Resistance. And I've actually been to Palestine and visited with some of these people. I was in Berlin, and I met Abdullah Abdurrahman, who's one of the leaders of the Popular Committee there. a school teacher and the most wonderful person you could ever imagine, who was arrested a number of months ago. And when they finally charged him, they charged him with possession of weapons. And the weapons he was charged with possession were the spent tear gas canisters and bullet casings that had been shot at the nonviolent demonstrators by the Israeli Defense Forces that he had collected in his house and organized in a peace symbol. And that is, I sort of, the best kind of anecdote I can think of to say what really is going on, unlike your expert from the think tank here. And the other thing I wanted to mention, one of our local residents, a wonderful young woman by the name of Emily Hanakowitz, who was in who's is Jewish and whose family's from Israel, was in Israel studying. She's an artist, an absolutely amazing artist. And she went to, with some of her Israeli friends, to some of these demonstrations in Sheikh Jarrah and was just shocked at what she was seeing. And on May 31st, she was in a nonviolent demonstrating, just holding a flag in solidarity for the people who had been shot on the Free Gaza flotilla. And she was targeted by an Israeli soldier who shot tear gas grenades directly at her, one of which hit her face and put out her eye. There have been a number of other nonviolent demonstrators who've been shot with these tear gas grenades, which are not supposed to be used as bullets, and a wonderful young man from Berlin who was actually killed by them, and another American by the name of Tristan Anderson, who was shot over a year or more ago and who suffered damage and horrible things.
Okay.
So this is something that has been going on for a long time.
Okay, and thanks for your call. And just to remind you, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. David, go right ahead.
I was just going to say, look, I think, you know, the callers are right that there have been incidents of nonviolence in the past. You know, if Yasser Arafat was Martin Luther King, there'd be a Palestinian state 30 years ago. When the Israelis got out of Gaza, the Israelis have gotten out of Lebanon, they've been hit by 3,300 rockets of Gaza. If the nonviolence becomes the defining characteristic, not just incidents of it, if it's the defining aspect, coupled with negotiations for a negotiated solution based on dignity for both sides, I think this is possible. Unfortunately, in my view, this has been more the exception than the rule, and that's been the problem. I hope that will no longer be the case.
Ronit?
I think that, you know, what a lot of these nonviolent demonstrators are facing is a lack of differentiation. So the military is taking a military response to nonviolent civil disobedience. And so people are getting beaten and they're getting killed and they're not seeing that. I wish that the Israeli military and government would actually embrace the nonviolent movements that are happening in Palestinian society today.
And, of course, the same thing happened here in the United States with the civil rights movement.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's very typical of most state responses to nonviolent civil disobedience. It's not that Israel is exceptional in that, but I think that they are making a major, major strategic and ethical mistake to not encourage or support or at least not detain or harm or shoot at or round up and intimidate the nonviolence leaders in Palestinian society so that people can really feel that there is a political horizon that can emerge from this. And, you know, when we showed the film in Dubai, it was very interesting. We opened at the Dubai International Film Festival in December. And there were some people in the audience who just felt that nonviolence couldn't work, that you know, there were cynics and skeptics who felt that the Israeli government and military only understood force. And that kind of logic on both sides of this conflict is absolutely detrimental to the well-being of human beings.
The question, you've talked about Fatah, but the question is, what about Hamas? And to what extent will Hamas go along with this nonviolent approach, Julia?
That's a key point.
All right, David,
absolutely.
Hold on.
David, I would love to invite you to come to our screening tomorrow, and you will be able to, well, tonight and on Saturday. So tonight we have a screening at 7:15 p.m. If you can come, you will see the Hamas participation in the demonstrations. Boudrous united all political parties. One of the people that we follow in our film is Ahmed Dawad, who is the leader of Hamas in the village of Boudrous, who was very involved in the demonstration, talks about the importance of using nonviolent resistance, how he welcomed and was surprised at first by the Israeli participants who came to support him, and how he continues to support this strategy. And you can see the same thing happening in villages across the West Bank and in even some villages in Gaza.
And I wonder, Ayad, has your own view of Israel changed in this process?
Yes, but I want to mention something about Ahmed Awad. Ahmed Awad is a Hamas member from and create or initiate in the first time the involvement of Hamas people in nonviolent struggling. He was speaking clearly, loudly about nonviolence and how to use the Israelis, how to work with the Israelis and to respect them. And after that, they detained him and put him in, under the administrative detention without government for 9 months. So I think that they are just following the name, if he's Hamas, but without care if he's non-violence or a violence.
Well, so, I'm afraid we've got to end it there. Ayat Marar, he's an employee of the Palestinian Interior Ministry. He is featured in the new film Boudras. Julia Basha directed, produced, and wrote that feature. Ronit Avni is founder and executive director of Just Vision. Thank you all so much. The information about the film is linked to our website, drshow.org.